We're going to start by introducing our faculty. I'll call you Tony. I know Tony. He's a friend of mine for a long time. Thanks for joining us. He's a professor of medicine, oncology, Mayo Clinic, Arizona. And Dr. Rolika Mehta, professor of medicine in Tampa, Florida. Thanks for joining us. It's going to be an exciting session. You just came from ASCO GI, and I'm sure you're going to share a lot of data and maybe keep us a little bit, more confused with a lot of options. So I will start, and Dr. Needlove, if you want to say a couple of words, or we could go ahead.
Yeah, just welcome. We're looking forward to lots of cover here today. We're going to start out with colorectal cancer, then get into upper GI cancers, biliary tract cancers, where all of a sudden there's a lot to talk about, and finally HCC and pancreatic. Tony, we asked people to put together chalk talks, but Tony really did a chalk talk. You know, we had this idea, you know, you're walking down the hall making rounds and you stop at the marker board. And well, of course, Tony took it to the next level. Anyhow, Tony, you heard what the breast people are saying about cell-free DNA. Maybe they're still sticking around to get a flavor of maybe where they're going to be in a couple years. But anyhow, maybe you could talk a little bit about what's new with colorectal cancer, Tony.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're for once, I feel like we're a little bit ahead of breast with the circulating tumor DNA piece. So I rarely get excited about something ahead of breast cancer. So the discussion question is, in which setting, if any, would you order circulating tumor DNA for MRD assay? And if we currently use this to inform decisions for patients' treatment. So here's my board. They don't exist anymore in and around, but I still love those things. Especially if you want to torture the medical students a little bit and just scratch it a little bit on that board. But anyways, so circulating tumor DNA detection, this has the potential to transform our clinical practice and multiple levels. But I think since we're talking primarily about the early stages, you know, it may help us actually understand the risk of relapse. So that's what we call, you know, MRD assessment. At this point of time, it's primarily a prognostic element, although we're learning a little bit more about its potential predictive value, which is more important for us, of course, than just to say, hey, you know, I think your tumor is going to come back, but I don't know what I'm going to do about it. I actually want to use this test so I can know what to do about it. There are two platforms that are available to us, what we call a tumor-informed and a tumor-naive platform. So the tumor-informed platform, meaning essentially it doesn't matter where, if it's colon or whatever else, you take the tumor, you match, you know, certain aspects of the tumor alterations to the blood, and that's how you follow patients up. The tumor naive platform is one that doesn't really care about what's in the tissue. It just says, you know, colon cancer, there are 16 elements, methylated DNA elements that I want to look at, and that's what I'm going to try to match. Now, there are pluses and minuses about both. I like better the tumor-informed platform because I think it has higher levels of sensitivity, but the limitation, of course, as we progress in using these in later lines of therapy is that tissue may become an issue. So when we think about residual disease detection at earlier time points, so we want to think not only about are we going to give that patient additional chemo or what have you, but also do we go more aggressively on imaging surveillance or CA or what have you. And will this allow for improved patient selection for? Let's talk first about adjuvant chemotherapy or duration. So we've had multiple hints here and there that this may actually work for patients. This study is now published in a New England Journal of Medicine. Dynamic was presented at ASCO in 2022. It took stage 2 colon cancer, and essentially those are the patients that typically, you would do standard management, meaning you decide whether you give them treatment or not based on clinical pathologic criteria. Patients were randomized to, one, I do the ctDNA, if it's positive, we go with adjuvant chemotherapy. If it's negative, I just observe. And then the other arm was standard management. So real world, in some ways, you know, you decide what you want to do. The primary endpoint was a non-inferiority of relapse-free survival rate at 2 years. And I think there's a key secondary endpoint here, which is proportion of patients receiving adjuvant therapy. So first, principle of do no harm, well, that was positive. The fact that, you know, patients that ended up going on or being randomized to the arm that assessed MRD, and decision was made based on the findings from MRD, did not appear to do worse than those where you actually just used your clinical judgment. Important. But I think when we look at this key secondary endpoint of adjuvant chemotherapy, less patients in the arm that actually based decision on MRD assessment received chemotherapy. But there's a caveat. More of those who received adjuvant chemotherapy ended up having more aggressive chemotherapy with oxaliplatin, so they were considered higher risk. How that played out ultimately, and with the two arms is difficult to say. It's a small study, relatively speaking. And I think most importantly is in actual practice, because that included high risk stage two patients. In actual practice, if a patient with a high risk stage two disease ends up with MRD negative disease, will I deprive that patient the opportunity to get chemotherapy? Today, I wouldn't do that because I still think that there's some lack of sensitivity and specificity here. But overall, I think we're going in the right direction, and I see a lot of utility for this. The other thing is, of course, what's clear is that MRD assessment is better than CA in terms of predicting relapse, and even better than imaging in terms of earlier relapse. But most important, again, from the practical standpoint, if I have a patient who has MRD positive disease and I actually scan them a little bit more aggressively and get their CA more aggressively and follow them more aggressively, am I going to change ultimately their outcome? Is that going to actually change their survival outcome? We don't have that element yet. Randomized clinical trials, and a number of them are looking at those. I think today it's a case-by-case basis. And you have to sit down with the patient and have a deep discussion about the limitations of how to interpret the results of this. But I think we're getting pretty close to the point where we may be able to use MRD assessment for clinical decision making. We're not there yet for all patients, for some maybe, but we're on the right track.
Thank you. Actually, this is fascinating. Maybe Dr. Neil Love will have some question from the virtual attendees. Do you use this? I mean, because patients come to us and they ask about it. They want this test to be done, you know?
Yeah.
And do you consider maybe helping you like de-escalate some of the stage three disease, like one node positive that you're not sure? Do they need like 3 months versus 6 months? Can that help? And then are we doing studies in that direction?
So it can help in the larger discussion. To use it solely to predict one way or the other is a no, I think, at this point of time. But as an assist, so the way I think about it is as an assist, where if I feel that the patient has some level of reluctance or the patient's asking for it, you have to really sit down and explain to the patient that this is not all the answer. This is only a little piece of that big pie, and we have to sit down and talk about it. So yes, it can assist with the discussion. It's a tricky discussion though, because I'm not as worried about the patients who may receive chemotherapy. I'm more worried about the patients who may be deprived from getting adjuvant chemotherapy based on a test that, 10% of the times may miss an actual negative, and that's my bigger concern than the positive that gets treated.
And I think if I recall the data, I think the vast majority of the patients, the dynamic T3 patients, I think 20% were T4, so probably you will not offer that to T4 patients.
Yes, I wouldn't. I mean, if clinically it's indicated to treat the patient, if it's a T4, then you should treat the patient regardless whether it's negative or positive. And the other thing that's very important, and we haven't discussed that at length, but it's not just a single time point that's important. It's a longitudinal follow-up that actually is the most predictive. So one time point is not as predictive on its own. It's a longitudinal follow-up, and most of these patients were checked for all 3 years. At any point they turned positive, that was bad news for patients. But if they remain negative all the way through, that's fantastic news. It's not 100%, but it adds one layer. So we're learning more, I think. I think, again, in practice, we still have to take a step back and have a good discussion with the patient before we make that decision based on just a single test.
Just to get a second opinion from Rutika, just curious, outside of clinical trial right now, Rutika, are you using this assay, and in what situations?
So yes, I am using the assay, and again, as Dr. Saab pointed out, I think right now it's more of academic nature than clinical practice, but it helps me guide who is going to be that high-risk patient that's going to develop a relapse, helps me narrow down the imaging intervals. If I was supposed to bring them back in 6 months and I find a positive ctDNA, then I'm going to bring them back sooner. So I think for those instances, I'm using those.
So let's let Tony continue with his talk, really getting to some of the new things in colon cancer and management of MSI-high, but particularly HER2 colon cancer really came on the scene this past year. Tony, can you talk a little bit about these advances?
Absolutely. I mean, it's getting a very exciting time. Again, colorectal cancer is starting to look more and more interesting. Gone are the days of just, you know, spending all our time discussing FOLFOX versus FOLFIRI or triplet versus doublet, although some of these questions remain relevant. So first, I want to very quickly hammer down the role of immune therapy in MSI-high colorectal cancer. I'm going to break this down: early stage rectal, early stage colon, and then metastatic. In early stage rectal, we've seen some fantastic data. This is not the only set. There are other data sets with dostarlimab in stage 2 and 3 mismatch repair deficient rectal cancer. Why this is really good? Because essentially, all these patients so far have had a great response that spared them actually radiation or surgery. Now, this is a small group of patients. This was published in New England Journal of Medicine. We just heard that the FDA did not give the approval or the go for dostarlimab in the setting, pending more studies, which I think are needed, and a longer follow-up. This was a short-term follow-up. But it's amazing, and that's what actually we see in clinic. And I'll be frank, I mean, this not only applies to rectal cancer, but all the diseases where surgery is very morbid and can have some significant issues for the patients. And so I think, you know, this is setting us in the right direction. Not yet there, but almost. So for the other one that's exciting is early stage colon cancer. Again, this is a set, I mean, this is beautiful, beautiful, waterfall plot. I mean, you can see nicer than that in oncology. But you had major pathologic responses in 95%, with 67% of those patients getting pathologic CRs. Now, these patients got ipi/nivo. I'm not sure you need the ipi, to be frank, in this setting. But these patients got ipi/nivo and then went to surgery. Now, colon surgery is a little different than rectal surgery, and so, you know, one can question whether we really need to, you know, throw nivo/ipi at these patients and avoid the surgery that's commonly considered. But I think that goes with, you know, with the trend. If a patient does not want to go through surgery for whatever reason, or the patient has locally advanced disease that is unlikely to yield an R0 resection, perhaps with MSI-high, perhaps that makes sense. Metastatic colorectal cancer, you know, needless to say that we have just very solid data in first line versus chemotherapy with pembrolizumab versus chemotherapy of choice, both PFS significantly better, OS also better, although statistically perhaps not, just because there's a large crossover. But you can see that with the PFS, now this is going into 5 years, about 40% of the patients remain progression-free and alive and not needing chemotherapy. So literally, you can claim that at least for a third plus of the patients, you are curing their disease with 2 years of pembrolizumab. And the question is whether you need to add the CTLA-4 inhibitor that's being addressed now in CheckMate 90W. So early stage rectal cancer, or HAW, I'm sorry. Early stage rectal cancer, neoadjuvant, maybe. We still need more data. So, you know, studies are still looking at this. Early stage colon cancer, neoadjuvant, I'd say not yet, because, I mean, you really have to show value versus a surgery that's considered relatively less morbid than rectal surgery. For metastatic colorectal cancer, yes, in first line, and that's for pembrolizumab, and in rare cases, perhaps add the CTLA-4 inhibitor. How about HER2-targeted therapy in patients with HER2-expressing colorectal cancer? Again, the tailwinds of breast cancer, and then a little bit of gastric cancer. You know, colon cancer is becoming now a disease that belongs to the subset of HER2-positive driven cancers. 4% of the patients with colon cancer will have a HER2-positive expressing tumor. These also occur mostly on the left side, and 70% of them in the presence of fresh wild type. Now, this is important because a HER2-positive overexpressing tumor that's fresh wild type, that's on the left side, is a tumor that you typically, if you didn't have the HER2 result, you would consider an EGFR inhibitor, except now we know more and more, and we presented some of this data, that EGFR inhibitors do not work in the setting of a HER2-positive tumor. So important to get HER2-positive early in this management. So what do we know about some of the HER2 data in colorectal cancer? You know, we just got the first FDA approval for HER2-positive metastatic colorectal cancer in January 19th, 2023, with two drugs, tucatinib and trastuzumab. So this is the first approval. We presented this data at ESMO, at ESMO GI and ESMO, and this is being considered for publication now, where you can see, I mean, 38% of the patients had a response, and 65% of the patients had some level of response. And the beauty about this is that we still have patients on this study from cohort A that are now 4 or 5 years in either near complete response or complete remission, just on tucatinib, trastuzumab. So this actually now forms a standard of care for our patients that we didn't have before. Now we did have, right, some HER2 combinations on guidelines that were recommended for these patients, but we never had an approval, so that's the first approval. And this seems to be well tolerated with toxicities, and we do have also the opportunity now to move with trastuzumab deruxtecan as a second line or a third line post trastuzumab to tucatinib. And the reason why I say that is because, one, there's data post anti-HER2 therapies, but the toxicity concerns with trastuzumab deruxtecan, including with the higher dose that's used in colon cancer of interstitial lung disease, including patients that died from ILD, put it later in line, but you can see, again, very solid responses, 45%. These orange arrows show the patients that actually had prior anti-HER2 treatment, and you can see that regardless of prior anti-HER2 treatment, trastuzumab deruxtecan actually has an effect. Now that makes sense, right? Because trastuzumab deruxtecan is a targeted chemotherapy agent. And all what it cares about is the expression of the receptor, not as much whether the receptor is active or not. So you try your first shot with directing your treatment at shutting down the receptor's activity, and then your salvage would be one that just takes advantage of a receptor and deliver the chemotherapy intratumorally.
So we're going to move on in a second and have Rutika bring up some data on upper GI cancers. But just a couple of follow-up questions. One, Rutika, we actually have a question in the chat room from Charles, I guess, who has a patient who's got a high TM metastatic colorectal cancer, but a TMB over 20. How do you approach patients like that? You know, there is sort of a pan-tumor indication for TMB over 10 with Pembro, Rutika. What would you think when you have a patient with metastatic colon cancer with high TMB?
I mean, I would certainly check the MSI status with a high TMB. I'm always curious to know whether they're MSI high, but if they've gone through chemotherapy and are now looking for a next line of treatment in the settings of a pan-tumor approval of pembrolizumab for TMB greater than 10, I think that would be a good patient to offer pembrolizumab to.
So, Tony, and then we'll go to Dr. Nassat and see if he has any questions from the audience there, but just a couple more questions from the chat room, Tony. Sarah has a patient with a distal rectal cancer with neuroendocrine features. Would you approach that patient any differently than a typical patient with a pure adenocarcinoma, Tony? And also, assuming you had access to both tucatinib, trastuzumab, and T-DXd, in what situations would you want to use T-DXd first versus tucatinib, trastuzumab, particularly a patient who's symptomatic? So again, neuroendocrine rectal cancer, and then what comes first, HER2, Tony?
Yeah, so the, Great. The neuroendocrine cancer is a rare tumor in the colorectal. Those are the patients that I would treat very similarly, but different chemotherapy. So start with chemotherapy, consolidate with chemo RT, and then go to surgery. I wouldn't go to surgery straight with those patients. And so typically use regimens that we would use with small cell. I'm assuming neuroendocrine, but small cell. So a higher Ki-67, that's what I'm assuming, not a low-grade neuroendocrine tumor, which is a completely different beast. So for the higher-grade neuroendocrine, I would treat with chemo. You could consider IRI-CIS or CIS-ETO, and then chemorad, and then surgery. For sequencing HER2 target therapy, you know, this is again getting it to be an exciting time for us. I would start both trastuzumab deruxtecan and trastuzumab tucatinib have very similar response rates historically. They've never been compared. Trastuzumab tucatinib is approved. Trastuzumab deruxtecan is not in the setting. But regardless, trastuzumab tucatinib, and I've worked with both, and I'm sure a lot of you have, is easier in terms of the toxicities. And again, like I said, its activity is primarily directed at the receptor. And so I would start with trastuzumab and tucatinib as the first line of attack. And for those patients who fail trastuzumab tucatinib, since we do have the data with trastuzumab deruxtecan post and other anti-HER2 treatment, that would be my second layer. For that reason, and the other reason is certainly that there's a higher level of toxicity with trastuzumab deruxtecan, so I'd like to push it to later lines.
Tony, I have a question. My question is about the HER2 testing. You know, we understand that HER2 could be a mechanism of resistance to EGFR monoclonal antibodies. I mean, do you go test them again, or liquid biopsy is good for these patients to detect that? And do you think that, you know, you focus more on the EGFR-treated patient where that the chance is going to be higher?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. So we are going to present some data, I hope, at ASCO that looks at the concordance of all these platforms, liquid tissue, IHC versus next generation sequencing. We've done a lot of that work on the Mountaineer study. But what I can tell you is that, at least from the practical standpoint in my clinic, I've found actually the liquid biopsies highly concordant with what I find in tissue, meaning at a certain level, the amplification found in the circulating tumor DNA correlates nicely with overexpression. The only caveat, and that actually helps, so when I see a patient with colon cancer, first time I see them in clinic, I'm getting a liquid biopsy and I'm sending that tissue for next generation sequencing. And the liquid biopsy gives me the answer within 6 to 7 days, with one caveat just to keep in mind, that we still have a little bit of a sensitivity issue for some. Meaning if you find it in liquid, it's definitely in tissue. If you don't find it in liquid, still look for it in tissue. And that's the important aspect of things. So very quickly, RAS correlates at the rate of 95%+. HER2, you know, we think above 90%. So very quickly you will get your answer about whether an EGFR inhibitor would make sense in that setting or not. Sequentially, you know, we're still trying to learn whether the amplifications are predictive of what's happening in the tissue. I suspect yes. So let's say, you know, a patient that you want to treat now with trastuzumab deruxtecan after they fail trastuzumab tucatinib, and you want to ensure that there's still some level of expression. So right now, to do that, you probably want to put a needle in a lesion, but that's also, you know, representative of just one spot. What I do in my clinic, I actually send another circulating tumor DNA test, and this is where, you know, you could see the summation of all the tumors, and if there's still amplification, I'm more excited about moving to trastuzumab deruxtecan.
And another question, I would call it burning question, using immunotherapy, chemotherapy in these patients who have really, you need response yesterday. Do you use that?
Chemo-immuno with MSI high?
Correct, yes.
You know, I'm not sure, and I know a lot of people, you know, like to focus on the, from Keynote 177, on that little blip initially in the curve. I don't think actually there is much of a meaningful response, and we're seeing that more and more with follow-up studies with chemotherapy in the MSI-high patients. So I think you can get a really, really nice response with immuno alone. The question, the more relevant question is, can we enhance that response by adding a CTLA-4 inhibitor? And that study is still pending.
Thank you.
All right, so we'll be going into gastroesophageal cancers, which I like to call like the battle of immunotherapy right now. So the first question that I was asked to kind of comment on is what's kind of the standard of care for adjuvant nivolumab at this point in time? So historically speaking, we know patients with locally advanced esophageal or GE junction cancers can be treated with neoadjuvant intent chemoradiation, and then they can go for surgery. Now, patients who have had R0 resection, which means no microscopic residual cells at the margins, and still had residual disease, which means did not have pathologic complete response, now have a new standard of care to be offered. So CheckMate 577 was a study which looked at adjuvant nivolumab versus placebo, because we really didn't have anything at that point in time, and it did show a doubling of disease-free survival from 11 months with placebo to 22 months with offering adjuvant nivolumab for 1 year. So that is currently the standard practice, but again, the caveats being received chemoradiation, neoadjuvant intent, R0 resection, and no pathologic complete response. So those three criteria have to be met to offer someone adjuvant nivolumab, unless and until there is a contraindication to offer immunotherapy. Going to the next question, this is kind of the most complex one, I would say. What is kind of the role of immunotherapy in HER2-negative space, first-line metastatic gastroesophageal cancers? So I like to break it down by histologic subtypes, squamous cell carcinoma, adenocarcinoma, and then your tumor location being your tubular esophagus, GE junction, and gastric. So looking at your esophageal squamous cell carcinoma, you have two trials. One is a purely squamous cell trial, which is a CheckMate 648, looking at three different arms, chemo plus nevo, and then ipi plus nevo. Now, this trial did show that there was improvement in overall survival when you compare chemo plus nevo over chemo or ipi-nevo over chemo. There was also improvement of progression-free survival when you compared chemo-nevo versus chemo. And this kind of led to the FDA approval of both these regimens, which is chemo-nevo plus or ipi-nevo. Again, patient criteria need to be kind of borne in mind whether when you're offering ipi-nevo in squamous cell cancers of the esophagus. Somebody with maybe low burden of disease who is not extremely symptomatic from their primary tumor could be a potential good candidate. I usually kind of refer to patients who have had probably esophagectomy and now coming with maybe an isolated liver lesion. That might be a good candidate for ipi-nevo with some great responses. In patients who have more bulky tumor where we have concerns of a T fistula because your squamous cell esophageal cancer is a pretty high risk for developing a T fistula, that would not be my ideal candidate to consider ipi-nevo. I would probably look for a more chemo-based regimen to try to reduce the bulk of the tumor. The second trial that was in this space was the KEYNOTE 590, which was, I call, like a mixed bag trial with both squamous and adenocarcinoma histologies, but that also showed there was an improvement of overall and progression-free survival when you looked at chemo plus pembro versus chemo. Again, the hazard ratios do become much lower when we sub-select for a patient population based on their PD-L1 status, which is CPS of 10 or more, hazard ratios are much better. So again, with the squamous cell population, I usually don't kind of limit it to the PD-L1 status because it was seen in that study that about 90% or over 90% of patients were PD-L1 CPS of 10, or CPS of 1, I'm sorry. With the esophageal tubular adenocarcinomas, you have, again, the KEYNOTE 590 that I mentioned, but you also have the CheckMate 649. Again, improvement of both OS and PFS when you compared chemo plus nevo versus chemo. Again, NCCN guidelines do restrict it or do prefer that you offer it to patients with high PD-L1 scores, which is CPS of 5 or more for the NEVO studies. And again, because of the hazard ratios do become much lower when we select for those. If you are a CPS negative, which means PD-L1 negative, zero, the standard of care should still be chemo. That would not be a patient population that would benefit from the addition of immunotherapy. And then I would like to briefly talk about the new press release, or also was actually presented this week, which was Keynote 859, which is their adenocarcinoma trial looking at G-junction and gastric cancer, again demonstrating that there was improvement of both overall survival and progression-free survival when we looked at chemo-plembro versus chemo. Now, diving into kind of HER2-positive space and how do I treat HER2-positive and how do I sequence therapy. First-line treatment, again, Keynote 811. Sorry, a lot of keynotes and checkmates here. But Keynote 811 looked at your TOGA regimen, which is chemo plus trastuzumab versus chemo trastuzumab pembro, with the basis that trastuzumab and pembro have a synergistic effect. And about 85% of the patients were PD-L1 positive CPS of one or more. And there are some preclinical studies which show that when you do have HER2 amplification, there is also more PD-L1 positivity in the microenvironment. So typically, if I have a HER2 positive patients, I really don't look for their PD-L1 status. Regardless of their PD-L1 status, I would offer them the chemo plus trastuzumab plus pembro as a first-line treatment. For second line or third line beyond, you have the DESTINY studies, and I'd like to kind of quickly discuss those here. So you have your DESTINY Gastric 01, which was primarily a third line or beyond study, primarily conducted in Asia, but a randomized trial looking at TDXD or femtrastuzumab deruxtecan versus investigator's choice chemo. In this study, there was no confirmation of HER2 positivity prior to enrolling patients onto this trial. So if they were known to be HER2 positive based on the fact that they received trastuzumab-based regimen, they were eligible for this trial. The DESTINY Gastric 02, on the other hand, was mostly a Western population study, more so as a proof of concept to kind of lay down the basis that TDXD is a valid regimen for the Western population as well. On this trial, this was a single-arm 79-patient study. The patients did undergo central HER2 testing confirmation prior to being enrolled onto the study, and this was considered second line or beyond. The reason for HER2 testing, and that's important, is because you do see about, depending on studies, you will see anywhere between 30 to 60% patients can have that HER2 loss as you treat them with trastuzumab-based therapy. So looking at kind of the overall survival and progression-free survival curves on the left from the DESTINY Gastric 01 study, you can see a significant improvement of both OS and PFS with TDXD. Now, what was kind of the second line standard treatment option? That was the RAINBOW, which is ramucirumab plus paclitaxel. And again, no cross-trial comparisons, but if you had a patient that was HER2 positive and you were thinking of, should I give them TDXD versus ramucirumab paclitaxel, if they still retain their HER2 positivity, then would you want a patient to potentially get that median overall survival of 12 months, versus do you want the patient to get that median overall survival with ramucirumab paclitaxel of 9.6 months? So that's kind of the assessment that you would need to make before kind of subjecting patients to TDXD versus rem plus paclitaxel. Confirmed ORR is kind of their thing with TDXD studies, and again, with the DESTINY Gastric 01, probably 43%, but when you look at DESTINY Gastric 02 in the Western population, 38%. That's kind of where most of their studies seem with overall response rates. Safety is a big issue with TDXD, as Dr. Saab pointed out. Again, 85% of patients had grade 3 or more adverse events with TDXD, and that's a large patient population to have grade 3 or more side effects. The important ones, pneumonitis. Again, no deaths due to pneumonitis, but there were about 16 patients that did have pneumonitis, low grade. There was one death in the study not related to pneumonitis but due to pneumonia. So again, when we're offering patients and we're looking at patients at the second line setting, if they're not HER2 positive, my practice would be to offer them ramucirumab paclitaxel in favor of low toxicity and the fact that I don't think they might potentially have a response if they're not HER2 positive. And there could be a debate on how do I check HER2 positivity. As Dr. Saab pointed out, I think my practice is the same, ctDNA plus tissue testing, and I kind of gauge according to that. But if they are still retaining HER2 positivity at the second line, and we're really not concerned about toxicity, and the patient seems otherwise fit, then TDXD would be a good choice. The next question is about Claudin 18.2. So putting a spotlight now on Claudin 18.2, this was the much awaited data that was released at GI ASCO past month. So Claudin 18.2 is kind of a gap junction protein that is typically found in normal gastric cells. And with tumor progression, you can see that these gap junction proteins come up to the surface. So therefore, they become a good biomarker for cancer purposes. So zolbetuximab is a monoclonal antibody that attacks the Claudin 18.2. And but studies kind of say about 30% of your patients can be Claudin 18.2 positive. Again, if you look at the actual data released with zolbetuximab in the SPOTLIGHT study, I would say of all the randomized patients, 20% of those were Claudin 18.2 positive. There is some overlap between Claudin 18.2 and PD-L1 because now the question becomes, you have so many biomarkers in this space, how do you prioritize treatments? And the overlap between Claudin 18.2 and PD-L1 CPS of 5 or more is about 13.2%. So let's look at what the zolbetuximab data showed. So again, Claudin 18.2 cannot be tested on ctDNA. It's an IHC-based testing, and so you require tissue. The IHC says moderate to strong staining of Claudin 18.2 in 75% or more cells that was considered to be positive, randomized to chemo versus chemo plus zolbetuximab. Again, bear in mind the comparator arm does not have an IO in that, so there's no immunotherapy, it's just chemo. Again, a lot of, more than two-thirds, I would say, 75% of the patients had low metastatic burden, so 0 to 2 metastatic sites. As I mentioned to you earlier, 13.2 patients were found to be PD-L1 CPS of 5 or more. And looking at some efficacy and safety data here, their primary endpoint was progression-free survival, and you can see a good separation of curves for the progression-free survival, but also for the overall survival. Here you can see that the overall median overall survival was about 18 months. The comparator arm, which was the control of chemo, did exceedingly well with 15 months of median overall survival. So that is one of the critique that this study received as to how come the comparator arm did so well. I do not have a good answer for that. Your response rates. Response rates are very comparable with the addition of zolbetuximab as compared to chemotherapy, so that was a little bit of a surprise that it did not give you more responses. Duration of response also seemed very similar with about 8.5 months. Now, if you go back to the CheckMate 649 study and you look for patients that are PD-L1 positive CPS of more, and you look for their duration of response with chemo plus IO, that duration of response is a little over 9 months. So again, if you want durability of response, which one would you select, in especially when that PD-L1 CPS of 5 or more category? The next thing to note is, again, adverse events. Again, a lot of patients, 86% of patients, had grade 3 or more adverse events with zolbetuximab, the most common ones being nausea, vomiting. That's a big one. If they have undergone gastrectomy, they potentially will have less side effects with nausea, vomiting, but if they do have their primary stomach intact, then you will experience this as a big side effect. Now, there was a paper that was published in 2021 by a group in Singapore kind of extracting or extrapolating data from CheckMate and Keynote studies and trying to look at your CPS of 1 to 4. So that's always like a clinical question that comes up. Okay, you talk about CPS 5 or more, but what if I have a patient CPS 3, CPS 4, should I still give them immunotherapy? So these smart researchers actually tried to do a KM subtraction method curves, and you can see on the right, which kind of shows the overall survival and the progression-free survival in patients with CPS of 1 to 4, and you essentially see that the curves overlap. Now again, this is not a direct data release from CheckMate 649, but this is an extraction method, so again, take it with a grain of salt. But if you had a similar patient population, CPS of 1 to 4, and you look at your zolbetuximab data, you can see some good overall survival benefit and progression-free survival benefit. So the answer is, if we do get zolbetuximab approved, and you have a patient in the CPS of 1 to 4, and claudin 18.2 positive, then I would rather offer them the zolbetuximab with chemotherapy rather than chemo plus immunotherapy. That would kind of be my short answer to it.
So, NASFAT, I was thinking about all the times we've done this meeting over the years, and there gets to be a point where your brain is starting to explode, and I think we're about at that point now. So I'm just going to say, look, this is just a tasting menu. We could spend 15 minutes just talking about the last 10 seconds of what we just talked about, but we just want to increase your awareness. NASFAT, I have a new saying, which is PD-1 and claudin 18.2 is the new ER and HER2 of GI cancer. Anyhow, we'll be dissecting this out for a long time. I want to give Tony a chance because we have a new first-line therapy of biliary tract cancers as of a year ago. I want to know what's been going on this past year. But just one quick question, Tony, before you start getting back on the train, so to speak, from earlier. We had a question of whether or not, you probably heard the discussion in breast cancer about the tucatinib HER-CLIMB regimen and brain mets. So we had a question in the chat room here about the whether we know anything about CNS activity of tucatinib trastuzumab.
Excellent question. And when you think about colorectal cancer, about 3% of the patients will have metastatic disease to the brain. But when you look at the HER2-positive colorectal cancer, it seems to be enriched in that subgroup, meaning that it's about 15 to 20% of the patients with HER2-positive colon cancer at some point will develop brain metastases. We are looking at that data from Mountaineer. Tucatinib has a good penetration to CNS. I can tell you, at least from the cohorts of patients I've treated, there were fewer than expected, but we don't have formalized data yet. And I'm actually optimistic that this may be an added benefit for tucatinib in colorectal cancer, HER2 positive. But we'll need to actually get that data a little bit more tightened up.
All right. So, Tony, we asked you to chat a little bit about biliary tract cancer, particularly, again, the big study looking at IO plus chemo first line and with durvalumab, the TOPAZ study.
So this really is a question about, the role of IO in patients with advanced biliary tract cancer. And so we know that today with the TOPAZ-1 study, durvalumab, which is a PD-L1 inhibitor, added to gemcitabine and cisplatin, is standard. And we'll talk very briefly about the data. This is from the TOPAZ-1, and you can see that the primary endpoint of OS was achieved, essentially. It's not overwhelming in that sense. There's definitely a subgroup of patients that seems to be benefiting more so than the global group of patients treated. The problem is we don't have a biomarker at this point of time. It didn't seem that PD-L1 expression had any relationship to that response, and other biomarkers like TMB and MSI-high, of course, rare, and likely didn't drive this. So it's unclear, if we're going to have any biomarker. The good news is, there is a second agent now, pembrolizumab, added to GemCis that appears to be positive through a press release. We're waiting on the full data. Then the next question is, of course, when we look at the landscape of biliary tract cancer, when you think biliary tract cancer, these are, rare cancers. But it's such a heterogeneous group of cancers, and they are loaded with actionable mutations from FGFR fusions to IDH mutations to HER2 amplifications. HER2 is actually becoming a very relevant target as well there, especially in gallbladder cancer. But how about FGFR2 fusions? And we'll talk briefly about this. As again, I said, KEYNOTE-966 with pembrolizumab is positive. So it's good to see now two studies consistently showing that adding IO to chemotherapy in biliary tract cancer does improve benefit. We'll see if the PD-1 looks any differently than the PD-L1. I'll tell you, in my own clinic, I actually use the every other week gemcitabine cisplatin. I prefer it over the weekly, less toxic. We published data on it. And it gives me the opportunity to give Durva every 4 weeks to lessen the burden on patients, especially those that actually end up responding on the long term, and many of them do. As I said, about 5 to 10% of patients with FGFR2 with intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma will have a fusion in FGFR2. And there are three agents that are approved in a very small space, and that's pemigatinib, futibatinib, and infigratinib. That's following GemCis failure. Infigratinib is possibly will be pulled out of the market and will stop development. I mean, again, it's a tough small space. What you see is response rates in about 30 to 40% of patients, and many of them are actually quite durable. So if you find that FGFR2 fusion in intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, there's a good yield of response and durable for some. Toxicities are hypophosphatemia, which, you know, initially we were more upset about it, but now we know how to manage it a little bit easier. Skin and ocular toxicities, including paronychia, is actually an issue, and so you have to really pay attention to those. when we think about sequencing, again, you know, we're thinking about a very small subset of patients, and we have all these agents. They all seem to be, when you look at all their waterfall plots, they look very similar. The question is, you know, can we start with one, and can we salvage with another one? The only data we have is with futibatinib salvaging patients with infigratinib who failed infigratinib, a small series, based on the fact that futibatinib actually covers more mutations, including some of the mutations that may arise as a mechanism of resistance to FGFR2 fusion. So in my practice, I typically start with pemigatinib for those patients and then can follow up with futibatinib with some responses being observed. Now, pemigatinib is the only one that's moving to first line. Others started moving, and then ultimately the study stopped because it's a rare population and it's tough to actually have all these studies. So pemigatinib with FIGHT-302 is the only one looking at GemCis. Noted that this is not GemCis Durva, it's GemCis. And the question is, you know, if our standard is GemCis Durva, does that study will make relevant sense in the future? And the short answer is difficult. Except for one thing, that if we look at the landscape of FGFR-driven tumors, for example, in bladder cancer, not my area of specialty, you would see that these are actually tend to be immune-depleted tumors. So there's a possibility that these FGFR-driven tumors don't benefit as much from IO, yet to be confirmed, actually, in biliary cancer. So I think it still is relevant as designed.
I was just flashing last night at about 11:45. We were talking about that exact issue in our bladder cancer symposia. Anyhow, let's move over to Ritika, who's going to talk a little bit about HCC, and then we got a ton of questions. We'll see how many of those we can cover after Ritika goes through what's new in HCC and pancreatic. Before you get started, Ritika, though, one thing just to preface this, I'm curious what your thoughts are. We're starting to see more information. There's always been this issue out there in HCC. Does it matter why they got, what the preceding issue was? Was it viral or not? And it seems like there's more data coming out about that question and whether or not checkpoint inhibitors are as effective in sort of the NASH non-viral patients. Before you start reviewing the data, Ritika, any thoughts about that line of research?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think that was one of the comments that was raised even with the studies that have been done. And I feel like more of the viral hepatitis patients tend to respond better to the IO-based regimen than your NASH patients. That's kind of at least the opinion that I have, and probably the opinion in a majority of academic centers that I can know of.
So we'll see after you go through some of these numbers, looking at again a sort of a anti-CTLA-4, anti-PD-1 strategy in HCC after having had sort of the Atezo-Bev approach. So why don't you go through that data, Ritika, and then we'll chat a little bit, see what Tony thinks about it too.
So HCC has become a very crowded space at this point in time, and I think there's good and bad. Good because we have more treatment options for our patients, bad because we really don't know how to sequence these therapies anymore. But we do have two new frontline options for HCC cancer patients based on the IMbrave 150 and the Himalaya study. So the IMbrave 150 is your Bev-Atezo combination, and the Himalaya study showed that there is either if patients are not eligible for doublet IO, then it's DERVA, or you also have TREMI DERVA. And again, here the thing to remember about this is TREMI one dose followed by DERVA alone. So it's not like you're doing PD-1 CTLA-4 combination continuously. Again, both have shown improvement in overall survival, and you can see response rates are also pretty good when you compare to kind of the standard backbone at that point in time, which was sorafenib, much improved response rates. So then that brings us to the question as to how do you, when you had all the TKIs in space, which is sorafenib and lenvatinib were the kind of the approved TKIs, when do you use those versus when do you use single agent IO if that were to be an option? So, you know, quite often we see patients who've had transplant for HCC and I want to come back with relapsed disease, still on immunosuppressant. Those are unfortunately not really great candidates for an IO-based regimen. TKI is a good option for those. Some patients cannot tolerate doublet IO. We do not think that that would be something that they can do. Then we do a single agent IO. Between Bevatizo versus the Himalaya combo, my bias is if the patient has not had an EGD, I'm not able to get an EGD in the near future because our gastroenterologists are pretty busy in their practice, or they've had an EGD but are untreatable, untreated varices, then my Himalaya combination becomes kind of the standard of choice for them. But if they had no other contraindications, then I go with Bevatizo as my as my option. In terms of progression after the first line treatment, if you have treated your patient with either the IMbrave 150 or Himalaya regimens, what do you do next? The short answer is nobody knows what's the right sequence of treatment, but there again, all these regimens have been approved after progression on a TKI, a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. Now, looking at regorafenib, cabozantinib, those are your two TKIs that can be used in second line or beyond space. Response rates are low. Your overall survival, median overall survival, is a little bit less than a year, but you do see two-thirds of your patients will have grade 3 or more side effects. When we look at ramucirumab data, that is strong only in your AFP high patients, so 400 or more. So that's the data for your high AFP patients. You do have a nivo-ipi combination as well. Again, the ipi dose is the higher dose, 3 mg/kg. So you do see a lot of immune-related adverse events with this combination. But that is the combination that has historically given you the longest median overall survival in the second-line setting. When we look at single-agent IO with pembro-nivo, again, you'll see a response rates of anywhere between 15 to 20%, and your OS benefit is anywhere about a year. So those are kind of your options in second line. Again, technically speaking, after TKI, but you potentially can do this after IMbrave 150 or Himalaya as well. And then looking at your pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma patients, how do you do germline testing and somatic testing, or do you do one or the one or both? So the short answer is both. Do not do a short panel of just BRCA testing. Do an expanded panel for germline testing. Your somatic testing should be technically tissue-based next-generation sequencing, but if tissue isn't available, then please do ctDNA. Other than BRCA1, BRCA2, there are other germline mutations that have been linked to having a lifetime risk of pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma. There is data with now germline PALB2 also along with BRCA1, BRCA2. The reason we have started testing patients for germline mutations in pancreatic ductal carcinoma is because of the Apollo trial, which showed that patients who were treated, and again, these germline mutation patients are not very common, about 3 to 5%. And if you kind of expand it to other HRD statuses, it may be up to 7%. But these are, again, fewer to find. But if you do see patients with that and you treated them with chemotherapy and have had stable to partial response at 16 weeks, then you can offer them maintenance PARP inhibitor. So that's the new standard of care. In terms of your chemotherapy backbone choice, I would use a platinum. So if you were inclined to use gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel, then try to swap that with an oxaliplatin or a cisplatin regimen. If the patient is candidate for a triplet regimen, you could do FOLFIRINOX. If you think gemcitabine is not an option, or you cannot do gemcitabine cisplatin, and you cannot do gemcitabine oxaliplatin, then FOLFOX can also be an option. But a platinum-based regimen for your germline mutated or germline mutated patients is essential. So that's kind of my take-home points for pancreatic cancer.
So maybe if we can just close out with a couple of questions to follow up what Rutika just presented, get from Tony, and then we'll go to NASFAT for final questions from the live audience. So Tony, you know you have a patient who has a BRCA germline mutation. Rutika says it's not very common, 5%, but the lung cancer people will go, oh, 5%, that's a lot of people. In any event, you know that you've got a patient with pancreatic cancer and a BRCA germline, Tony, just to make it simple. How are you thinking in terms of when and where you're going to integrate a PARP inhibitor into that patient's care, and how does that vary based on the stage?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, 5% is not little, and that's accounting both for somatic and germline. I think germline is probably a little bit less, but assuming germline, and I would treat somatic like germline, that brings you to about 5-6%. And my preference is to start with the gemcitabine cisplatin, low-dose cisplatin, you get great results. When do you integrate the PARP inhibitor is an important question, because if we look at the data, olaparib does not improve survival, it does improve progression-free survival. It does also come with its own flare of toxicities and costs. So the question is, you know, does an oral agent replace an IV or even a break? So I'll tell you, if a patient had a CR, and actually a good proportion of patients, up to 20%, will have a complete response, I actually discuss a break. Those are the patients that may actually not even benefit from further treatment, and you can just observe them, let them get a rest, and many of them can go for a year or two. I've had patients actually going for 2 years without the need for more treatment before they recurred, and I just rechallenge them with the platinum. The next question is, when I use GemCis, it's actually easier than FOLFIRINOX. You get about 70-75% response rate, and if you use the biweekly regimen, you can use it actually. I've used it on patients for a year plus with less toxicities and not needing to go to a PARP inhibitor. So the discussion about a PARP inhibitor is individualized. I said with the patient, we talk about the pluses and minuses. I think it has a role, but it's limited to those patients who have a stable disease or a PR, and those that you probably want to stop chemotherapy and you want to continue on something. As long as the patient understands, though, that it will not change the golden standard that we measure outcomes with, meaning survival, it will only delay progression. And that's an important discussion, especially for an agent that has its own toxicities.
So again, before going back to NASFAT for the final questions, Tony, getting back, Rutika was talking about this STRIDE regimen in HCC. So anti-CTLA-4 tremelimumab with anti-PD-1 durvalumab. A couple of questions in the chat room about toxicity. People are kind of referencing ipi/nivo when they think about this, but the STRIDE, they only, as Rutika mentioned, they only get one dose of CTLA-4. The use of the need for corticosteroids is about half, at least according to Katie Kelly, of what you see with ipi/nivo. Any comments on toxicity of the STRIDE regimen, Tony?
Yeah, no, the STRIDE regimen is easier than ipi/nivo. Ipi/nivo was designed in HCC to use the higher dose of ipi, lower dose of nivo because of the phase 2 randomized study. So it actually ends up being more toxic. The single dose tremi actually makes it easier in terms of lessening the toxicities, but I will say that there's a caveat to that. I don't think the data is as impressive as you would expect for a CTLA-4 plus PD-1, and part of it has to do with that single dosing. So perhaps we lose a little bit on historical efficacy from the combination of the two, but we make it actually easier to tolerate.
So NASFAT?
Yeah, thank you. Question, Tony. I mean, for TOPAZ trial-based, you know, treatment, if you cannot use cisgemcitabine with immune, could you use other regimen, single agent or FOLFOX, or how you approach that? And another question for you is just to kind of follow up on recent ASCO SWOG triplet regimen versus doublet in selected patients.
Yeah, so for the first is, you know, it's difficult to say whether you know, IO added to gemcitabine alone is going to do as well. I mean, the study was designed with gemcis, and whether, you know, if you swap it for FOLFOX, whether you're going to get the same benefit. Just again, to a point of clarification, the study was designed to give gemcis plus durva for 6 months, and then maintenance durva. Single agent PD-1, PD-L1 inhibitors have a very mixed track record with responses going from, you know, the 2% to, depending on what you look at, a little bit more above 10-20%. So I would assume that it should be fine in the sense if there's a reason not to give cisplatin.
And Brexane, gemcitabine, two agents.
Fine. Possibly. Yeah. But again, if you choose not to for whatever reason. For the unfortunate study with the SWOG study 1805, which essentially looked at gemcitabine, nab-paclitaxel, and cisplatin versus gemcitabine, cisplatin based on promising phase 2 data, that study was negative, essentially confirming in biliary cancer at least that more is not better, because there was another study from Europe that looked at FOLFIRINOX versus gemcis, also failed to show any benefit. So just upping the ante, going with more chemo, is not the answer in biliary tract cancer. And I think that just, you know, closes the deal on more chemo.
Thank you. For the last question to Dr. Mehta, resected HCC, do you offer them? I think there was a recent press release of some immunotherapy going.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that question?
Adjuvant.
Oh, yes.
HCC after resection.
Yeah, so I think that would, again, if it becomes a standard of care, then that would be, it was a very difficult to accrue study, to say the least, but yes, that would probably will become the next standard of care after resection. There's a lot of studies going on with TACE, with immunotherapy, all in the locally advanced setting. So again, how that plays out, going to become a very complicated scenario.
Thank you very much for our faculty. Great presentation, and we're going to take a 20-minute break for the next session. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.